You're listening to Four Seas, One Family, episode 60. Welcome to Four Seas, One Family, the podcast where expats and future expats can share and learn about life experiences abroad. I'm your host, James Thomas, coming to you from Taipei, Taiwan, and I'm so glad to have you traveling along with me on this journey, and welcome to the show. Today's going to be a little short episode here, and I'm kind of happy that I had the opportunity to put this show together with my friend, Todd Friends. Now, I haven't seen Todd in years, and this time I'm just lucky to have him in the studio. Now, he happened to be in Taiwan preparing something for school. He's an assistant professor, and I'll let him talk about that more. And I'm going to sit down and talk to Todd today about his expat experience and how he is using his global service operation, leadership development, and cross-cultural management skills to teach his students. Beyond teaching his students the fundamentals of doing international business, he also stresses the importance of globalizing oneself, which can help build common familiarizations with dealing with people cross-culturally. Todd also shares with us the cultural obstacles he had to go through while working abroad and how he has translated his experiences to his students to help them get a better picture of what to expect when working abroad. Todd also points out how important it is to let it be known that you are eager to gain international experience and how sometimes, well, you can't be picky. So without further ado, let's listen to the interview.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, James. Good to be here in Taipei.
Hey, man, it's really good. I haven't seen you in 10 years, man.
Yeah.
10 years. So how do you feel to be back in Taipei?
I love Taipei. I absolutely love Taipei. I love walking around here. I think it's one of the friendliest cultures that exist. And, you know, I always feel very welcomed.
Wow. What brought you to the idea, the concept of like, hey, I'm going to go overseas and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of us start out with some type of foreign experience. Mine would have been when my dad took a sabbatical and I was 15 years old and I lived in Manchester, England for a year. Oh. And I attended an English high school, went straight in, mainstreamed and did O-levels. And it was a wake-up call, but it was, you know, in the end, it developed me well beyond anything that I thought it could. And that was the start. And then it's sometimes when doors open, you know, I heard on the radio one day, Cortland State University was going to open up the first cross-cultural exchange program with the University of Beijing. And I hunted down this guy called Jim Clark, the president.
Oh, yeah.
I said, I want in. He looked at me like I was, you know, just a typical country kid. Like, really, Todd? I didn't know you had such interest. I go, I want in. I talked to my parents. They're supporting me. I'll probably have to go to college an extra year, which I did.
Right.
And so it starts then, and you have it in the back of your mind, but still, you got to go to work. So you graduate. I was in the airline business. You know, you got to pay your, what I say, your domestic dues. But if you keep that line of vision and your passion, which I eventually pursued a master's in international management at the Thunderbird School of Global Management, that really began to accelerate and open doors. And again, I worked domestically, but then I got my first formal expatriate assignment in 1991 to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia with American Express International.
Cool.
I was there for 2 years. My first son was born there. You know, that's a big thing overseas. My wife was more keen on that than me. I was pretty nervous. And then came back. You get promotions, you know, because it gives you a lot of visibility, more skills. And the big opportunity came in 2001, just after 9/11. I headed back to Kuala Lumpur with American Express. I rejoined them to build what would become the American Express Kuala Lumpur Global Hub, which today is the world's largest authorization center for credit cards in the world. And I was there to 05. The challenges and the joy that everything you hope for in a expat experience. And I went home, like most of us go for a while. My kids needed to go home. And then luckily, I got an opportunity to come to Taiwan. I really always wanted to come to Taiwan for a couple of reasons. One, I speak mediocre Mandarin.
Oh, no, you speak better than that.
And and if there's one place where they speak Mandarin clear, it's Taiwan.
Oh.
So then you know you've got no excuse if you're not understanding it.
Well, little one slighted right there. You know, I should let the listener know that there's a little disclaimer here that, you know, Todd and I, we went to the Cortland State University, upstate New York, and Todd was the first batch of students to be sent, 1981,
right,
to Beijing. And how long you stayed in Beijing again now?
1 year in Beijing.
1 year in Beijing.
There are only 500 foreigners in all of Beijing.
Oh, wonderful.
You knew them. You could recognize
But why, them. Why Mandarin Chinese? Why? I mean,
it was clear. You know, that was 4 or 5 years after, you know, Nixon and the opening to China. I think 79, things began to accelerate. I had actually was conversational in Spanish, but I said, Mandarin's it.
Mm.
You know, China's, Asia's where it's at. There's going to be more dollars going across the Pacific to the U.S., and that's what I pursued, and it's been a lifetime.
When you tell your friends, you told your friends at that time, you know, 1981, I'm going to China and learn Chinese. Like, why are you going to study that language? It's not useful. They wouldn't say that today, huh?
No.
See, we're the first group, and I was in 84.
Right.
And, wow, well, we can...
Pioneers.
Yeah, for real, for real.
I mean, yeah, you know, you travel, you're the first foreigner people have seen, you know, they keep you up all night on trains.
Oh, goodness.
Asking you questions.
Quite interesting questions.
You know, it was a unique time.
Yeah, those questions can be a separate podcast and for real. But you listen to what you've done over the years. I mean, you really kept moving. And you're an associate professor at the school. I don't want to get the name right here. Get it wrong.
Whitworth University in Spokane, Washington.
International Business Management, something like that?
Yes.
For something like that, it is important. I mean, it is international to get out of your familiar environment. How much is it as a value to get out of your safety zone, get out of that safe cocoon and go? I mean, regardless of how little you have, you know, how do you manage to pass that on to your students or stress the importance of it?
Yeah, you have two types of students. You have the one that's already aspiring in that direction, and that one's a matter of coaching and directing. You hope to cultivate others, because my international business courses are required of someone doing accounting, finance, economics. It's required.
Right.
We're a school that emphasizes global perspective big time. And that's when you hopefully capture their interest and they realize that all business is global today.
Yes, for real.
And that if, you know, one thing I share with my students, I say, the one thing I can't teach in this classroom that you're going to need to do is learn how to take risk, no matter what I do. I mean, some of you get it through sports, other things, but you got to be able to go step off the safe ground and go out. And, you know, and it's not just, yes, you're going to go study abroad. And we really coach them to go for semesters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we prefer that, but some will go with a faculty-led 1 month,
right?
You know, till they get their comfort level up. But and I'm not biased to wherever. I just go someplace and preferably live someplace out of your language zone in a second language. And I always say it's not just the cross-cultural experience you're going to get there, but you're going to learn more about your own country and your own culture than you ever will by staying here. There's a famous quote, if you want to learn about your own culture, you must leave it.
You must leave.
So the reflection on that piece is just as valuable as what you pick up and all of these navigation skills and problem-solving skills that you're going to develop, being on your own in a culture outside of an English speaking culture.
Yes. Yes. What specifically, based on your past experiences that you gained from your overseas experience as far as communicating things? Because there's a lot of cultural, how'd you say, hurdles you have to get over sometimes. And, you know, the way you handle something, say, I'll say Beijing again, and how you handle it in Taiwan, how you handle it in Singapore or the Philippines, it'll be different. Are there any notable things that, you know?
You know, I think the most, you know, this is talked about time and time again. And I wish I almost knew back then what I know now. When you become a professor, you spend 5-6 years pursuing a PhD, and you study the theory behind what you and I experienced. When you're in the real world, you're working 50, 60 plus hours a week.
Right.
It's like, you have no time to pick up, like, well, what's the theory behind this?
Yes, right. You have time.
You know, why did no one say anything in that meeting.
Oh, nobody knew.
You know, and so, you know, the first is obviously the best example is the concept of face in Asia. Mm-hmm. You know, that you must always try to preserve face. And it's I think I've worked in mostly all the cultures in Asia. I've made some bad mistakes.
Which is normal.
And making people losing face. You know, I even in the early 90s when I came and I had international education, I didn't know when I might have called out a manager in a meeting that the other six people lost face as much as that person lost face. It took me a while to bump around, but then you do learn it. So you always learn how to do things successfully, how to deliver messages. And also, you know, when you're in Asia, you're often not likely to be challenged in a meeting mm-hmm. or employee. So you need to find other channels, what works in that culture for them to give you feedback or give you upward feedback or give you questions, you know, or step out of a meeting and find someone who is a cultural bridge. You know, 101 cross culture, always find a cultural bridge.
How do you find those?
Find someone who's brave enough to tell you what you don't want to hear.
I'm still working on that too. You know? You know, how do you find somebody?
You know, because in American business, they always say, oh, you don't want yes people. I don't buy that. I've been around so much senior management that can only surround themselves with clones and yes people. You know, but if you got the person that's got the guts to say, okay, can you tell me what just happened in that meeting? And they'll, you know, give you that. I've been fortunate to have a few of those voices directly share me. And I think I built from those. And up to my last experience in Taiwan, 06, 08, which had to do with the banking crisis here.
Okay.
We had to do a lot of recovery work. I had to do a downsizing here, was required. Because the banking business went upside down when the government put new bankruptcy laws in place. But that was one of my better, you know, orchestrations. I think I'd learned a lot by that point.
Are there any type of, like, things you have to correct people back home in their way of thinking with dealing with people from different cultures and stuff like
that? You know, I'm big on networking. And my students, they have to go beyond the book right away. The first day of class, I literally, if there's 25 students, I give them 25 cards, 25 different countries, and I put a business on the back of that card. It might say fast food. It might say retail. It might say clothing. It might say airline business. I give them 1 week to get as much research as possible. And this is how I grade you. So they go to the library. That's good. But what they really need to do is get a hold of people in those countries.
For real, huh?
And I have to say this, you have to realize most American students don't even know how to make an international phone call. I have to go through the process. I've got the school okay to dial. I tell them, try the embassy first to get a report on the coffee industry, but then reach out, try to call some coffee business there. And you know, I get feedback from my students, especially the ones that Todd, I was paranoid. But then when I finally made that phone call at midnight, you know, to someplace in the world, and someone picked up and they helped me, the clouds cleared. Mm-hmm. And so it's reaching out, and they learn the difference between book learning and what happens on the street.
Right.
And that's a powerful connection. I do coach them, be conscientious, holidays, the time of the day, the time of the week. You know, certain countries, even in U.S. embassies, English is not that proficient. So you have to be patient. I mean, you and I, we've been at this a long time, but trust me, when I start putting together travel study abroad for places like Thailand, I'm up for a long time that night. I get hung up on because Thais, is that a yes, yes? Or is that a yes, no?
Oh, goodness.
You know, we all know that in Asia. Some people don't like to say no to you.
Right.
So all of those little circumstances, and nowadays you can quickly get books, you know, the great book that's called Kiss Hands or Kiss Bow or Shake Hands. Mm. It's a great book. So there's a lot of quick stuff. But I think it helps to learn some basic cross-cultural theories, whether it's, we call it a Hofstede or globe dimensions.
Right.
And you don't have to memorize them, but when you're ready to go or get on that conference call with those three or four other time zones, you should do a little bit of work at what their perception of the project is or what an outcome is. And you and I know, you know, I've been on calls with six different time zones. The Americans are going to speak up. The Aussies are going to speak up. The Indians are going to speak up. But most likely the Chinese are not going to speak up. The Japanese are not going to speak up. Mm-hmm. So you have to develop you know, draw them out.
Yeah, the sensitivity.
Or in advance. You just got to be different.
Yeah, you can't go in there with your guns a-blazing, you know, because that really will hurt everybody.
They're going to be quiet.
And it does take a little bit of incentive sometimes, and being that culturally aware really helps a lot.
Well, the biggest, actually one of the biggest dichotomies for Americans don't differentiate much between what's an inner circle and an outer circle.
Clarify.
Well, that's like, you know, you have contacts. If we were back in America and we were in this meeting and you said you knew somebody such and such, I'd say, hey, can I speak to them? You'd probably open that door, okay? In Asia, you know, where it's much more seriously relationship-based, and you are not going to enter into the close relationship base until an incredible amount of trust.
Right, you got
to
prove
it. You know, the common joke is, you know, the Japanese have the Americans arrive. Americans come in proudly with their black and white and their contracts. And every Japanese person in the room is like, you know, you think you're so great. You're so proud of your black and white, straight shooting guns. I wouldn't trust you one so bit. You know, you'll just change this. I mean, you know, that's the common. Yet, and I've interviewed quite a few executives in my research. And in these cultures where relationship is based, where they laugh at this idea of like, everything's got to be black and white, everything's got to be contractual. So in South America and in Asia, where it's very relationship based, one thing is that when they've established that trust and they're in that inner circle, when they need to deliver change again, a new product, a new launch, they can do it at a shake of a hand.
That relationship.
They don't have to gather up the lawyers, the accountants, a whole bit, because guess what, Jim Thomas, I've done work with you. I trust you. And by the way, let me get you in touch with so-and-so. We just know that's how it is. And so there's a significant difference in Asia. You know, if you build that trust and you've been here, you have an inside group.
That takes time, and it's worth every bit of it. And I'm really appreciated. Now, you got a lot of projects on there. You got a big project coming up, huh?
A few projects. I balance between teaching and research. We're primarily a teaching college, and so I'm here in Taipei laying the groundwork for a study abroad course where I'll come here next year. It's called the Three Chinas. It's a comparative business trip between Beijing, Shanghai, and Taipei. And so I teach a course in advance, and the students will come for a week to Beijing. I mean, I don't like what I call as educational tourism. I'm not a big fan of short travel trips, but if you do a good course in advance, so they know a lot more and they hit the ground running, it's more effective. So I'll be with them 3 or 4 months in advance. We'll hit the ground running. They'll have follow-up work. But as you know, Beijing, Shanghai, Taipei, I'd love to take them to Hong Kong, but I just don't have the time in this one. And so I suspect that the paper, which will be a comparative paper they write at the end, and that really, anything you write comparatively makes you push and pull, gives you greater learning. And I'm looking forward to reading those, you know, about, they'll probably have 2-3 weeks after we return to write a fully loaded documented paper on the experience.
I'm glad I kidnapped you to bring you in here, you know, because I haven't seen you like 10 years, man. And, you know, we are from the same school back home. We kind of like we represent our Cortland State University, you know.
We have to mention that Cortland's a town which is known as having more cows than people.
And I miss it.
But it's dead in the middle of New York State, and it's a great college. It is a really great college.
And I'm really proud that, you know, they took the little South Bronx me and really changed my life, and meeting people like you to share with other experiences. You know, I always ask this question to everyone that's on my show. You know, if you were, regardless of what your discipline is, if you were contemplating going living abroad and things like that, you know, whether it is for, you know, education purposes, financial purposes, it's good that you should be willing to learn about the cultures. What advice would you give to those people who are in that frame of mind?
Well, I meet a lot of students. A lot of them always say, I want to travel. And I say, well, there's a difference between travel and really engaging a culture. And if they really want to go, I go, you got a car? Sell it. Sell it and go now, because what's going to happen after you get your degree, the day you graduate? You're going to go to work. And how many days off are you going to get? 2 weeks, maybe, if you're lucky, for the first 5 years. So this is your window of opportunity. And depending upon their readiness level, their language skills, Usually I send them someplace. A lot of them want to go to Europe. They're comfortable with that. I'm real hard if you want to go to Australia because they just want to go to beaches.
Okay too.
But, you know, New Zealand, but Hong Kong's good. Mm-hmm. You know, I encourage them to get their feet wet. And then, you know, try to get to a 200-300 level of language proficiency. I'll always ask them, what did you take in high school? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them have taken Spanish. I go, great. Okay, well, here's some options. Let's get you here, especially a homestay option.
Right.
Go to a program where you go to school for a semester, you live with a family, and then you can take your classes in English, but you're speaking Spanish at home. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get that first aha expatriate experience. Right. I mean, we all remember the pain of the first 2-3 months. Even when you speak the language, adjusting and learning to navigate, you are just toasted every night at 8 o'clock. It's like, what? Why am I so tired? And these guys are only 20 years old. But then 2-3 months into it, the aha happens. The language is a breakthrough. And I get to hear this from the students. And some will go back and do it again. And it, as you know, it's an addiction.
It is.
It's a serious addiction. And that's why in my current role, I'm able to go back out about once or every couple of years and take care of that. Because, I mean, I just miss it. I miss it. And it's one thing, with all due respect, to be successful in the U.S. You have mm-hmm. to pay your dues. And I actually encourage students, go work for a global company in the U.S., get recognized, get visible. Don't tell them you want to go international on day one.
Right. Please.
Not at all. Don't. But prove yourself. Pay your domestic dues. Every company has a dues-paying culture. And then, you know, let them know you're available. And when they come to you, don't be picky. You got to go where the grass is green. Yeah, don't be like, oh, I want to go to England. It's like, no. If they say, we need something in Vietnam and, you know, it's going to be a little difficult, say, you should go for it.
Yeah, I'm going.
And
I'm packed.
And that's how you get started and you get the reputation. And then, as you know, the network amongst expatriates is phenomenal. The world gets small real fast. And they know who can help them. It, you know, expats are about assignments. So you're doing knowledge sharing, exchange. Mm-hmm. You're brought in for a period of time to hopefully enhance or build a local, you know, nationalize a local operation.
Right.
And that's the tough part. When it's done, it's time to move on.
Yeah, I guess.
Or go home for a while.
Wow. So you got to be willing to stick your neck out there and hit the iron while it's hot.
Yeah. And the only thing I'd add there is, and we're just talking about the professional part. We know that the personal part is very challenging. You know, the rule is going abroad is either going to tighten your family or it's going to break them apart. You really got to be tuned in with who your partners are or who your family is or if you got kids, et cetera. Those are conversations that have to be had.
For real. You know, I really thank you for allowing me to kidnap you and drag you in here with your great radio voice. And I'm looking forward to seeing you next year, and maybe I can get some of your students on
that'd be a blast.
To hear what they got to say.
Absolutely.
Hey, Todd.
Thank you, James.
Thank you very much. And Todd, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you, what's the best way to find you?
You can find me at Whitworth University. It's easy. Just look me up on the email there, and it's all professors are listed.
Cool. And if you can drop by 4C1Family, leave us a message. We get it to Todd. You can leave it on our SpeakPipe pages, and we'll be glad to pass it over to Todd because I'm, you know, just getting Todd on for these few minutes. This is just a peek what he can say. He can put some information on you. So for 4C1Family, I'm James from Taipei.
Thank you, James.
Zaijian.
Thank you again for joining us here at 4C1Family. Drop by the website 4C1Family.com. And if you have an iOS device, please download our app and it'll help us keep in touch with you and also help you share your thoughts and probably give us some advice on what you would like us to cover here at 4C1Family.com. Four C's One Family is the production of the World Data Exchange Video Network, WDEVN.